Today is Tuesday, May 7th, 2024, and this is part 7 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Ellen Hudgin. Ellen spells her last name H-U-D-G-I-N, and Ellen's son Douglas, or Doug, same last name. Good morning, Ellen and Doug. How are you today?
Good morning, thank you. Good morning to you.
Doing good.
Good. Glad to hear it. May we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you. And Doug, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the phone?
Yes, sir.
Super. Thank you. And last time in part 6, we talked about the move from the Grand Canyon Airport, located right on the north side of Red Butte, to the new Grand Canyon Airport, adjacent to Tucson, the gateway community to the south rim of Grand Canyon. And moving airports meant that the Red Butte Airport had to actually be closed and the runway ripped up so no planes could land there. And that put some hardship, I would say, quite a lot of hardship on Hudgin's operations there at the South Rim, and we talked about that yesterday. One of the things that happened, if I get this right, after the move to the new airport, was that Henry had an unusual adventure, I should say, I guess, that he hadn't had before. If I have this correct, and please jump in if there's, this is a repeated operation, but he ended up landing his plane on the ground in Marble Canyon, which hadn't been incorporated into the larger Grand Canyon National Park. That was going to happen in 1975, and this is in the late 1960s. Ellen, can you pick this up first, this story, and what you recall about it, and then we'll shift to you, Doug.
Yes, it was quite an unusual day. We had, all of us, we had, Doug spoke to you about that. We had this twin-engine Dove that carried, was it 11 or 12 people, Doug?
Yes.
Okay, and and another airplane, too, because there was many of us. We had just landed that day in the afternoon, I don't know what time, after burying Henry's mother. And some friends of ours that we had just met a few months before, their family had come up to spend a few days with us in their trailer. And so Henry had taken them for a ride, all of the family, you know, separately. And then we had gone, all of the rest of us, after they'd had the ride, except for the boys, we went back to, because at that time we were still living at the airport. We couldn't fly off of the airport. And these friends had bought steaks, and he wanted to start cooking them around 6 or whatever time it was. And I said, no, we'll wait until it's dark, because then there's no flying, and, you know, they'll be home. Well, it got darker and darker, and I did suggest that he cook them. I honestly can't tell you whether we ate them or not. It's just, that's kind of a blur. But because we had no phone line, there was no sense in going out to the airport in another car, because they could have passed us on the highway.
Oh, right.
And so it was after 9 o'clock when Henry came home with the boys. And told us that the engine had quit at the bottom of the, over the river, the Colorado River, and he had 5 passengers, or was it 6?
6. Well, no, it was five.
Yeah, I thought it was five. Five passengers, yeah. And it was a Cherokee 6, right?
Yeah.
And while we were waiting for them, another one of our pilots was on another flight, scenic flight, and Henry saw him and hit the radios. And it, when they landed, am I going too quick?
You know, I'm just putting together a list of questions here, and so why don't we back up a little bit? You mentioned that there was a twin-engine Dove, 11 or 12-seater, and that landed in the afternoon, and that was the day of Henry's mother's funeral. Was that funeral in Tucson?
Yes, it was.
Okay. Probably in the morning?
I assume.
Okay.
It was the day before.
What?
It was the day before.
Oh, the funeral was the day before?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that would make sense. And then, do you remember how old she was?
Oh dear. Well, she had to be in her probably her 90s.
Okay.
I know she was older than my mother, and every summer I had Henry's mother and my mother living with us up at the canyon.
Okay.
And we had flown Henry's mother to Tucson because she was not feeling well.
Oh, you mean just earlier that summer?
Probably about a month before that.
Oh.
We had flown her back to Tucson for for help.
What was her name again?
Marie Hudgens.
Okay.
And so anyway, that was what had happened that day.
Okay. And so then she'd passed away, and this was in what was the year here? 1967. Okay, 1967. So this is the summer of 67. So you all get into the twin-engine Dove. That's you and Henry and the boys. Who else
and
was?
Margaret and Palin and Walter and my mother and nieces and nephews anyway that were working, with us.
Okay.
Staying this summer and working.
Okay.
On the ramp. Not
All right.
as pilots, but on the ramp.
All right. So this is basically the entire Hudgens team here.
Yep.
Is
we have two airplanes, though. The other airplane was full as well, with 9 of us in it.
That was the Cherokee 6?
Yes. Uh-huh.
So both the Cherokee and the Dove had flown from Tucson up to the south, up to Grand Canyon that morning or that day.
Yes.
Okay. And then, I'm just writing this down, Cherokee and Dove, Tucson to Grand Canyon that day. The phone, once again, that pesky phone. was it to the point now where y'all just figured that the phone wasn't necessarily needed because y'all were working out of the Tucson airport? Or was it just one of those times when the phone had broken down as it normally did?
Oh, no. The phone hadn't even been started yet because...
Yeah, it was there.
Pardon?
It was there, Mom.
Well, I thought then... If the phone was there, and see, I'm kind of confused. If the phone
the problem is there was no way to call because the two lines were hooked together at the new airport and at the old airport. So, the only way talk to each other is if we coincidentally picked up the receiver at the same time.
So the line out to Red Butte was basically a one-way line, and you needed somebody on the other end to be talking before you could, almost like a party line thing. But
yeah.
But when it rang or to call out, that was happening that went to a trailer or to a terminal desk there at the airport, at the new airport?
So it was like a single line.
Okay.
It's like having two lines in your house, you know. You can't call the other phone at the other end of your house.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So you could call out, but you didn't want to call out. You wanted to call the other room, if you will.
Right.
And there was no way you could do that because the phone isn't set up to do that. Got it.
Right.
You would need two phone lines, one individual line going to Red Butte and one individual line going to Tucson to make that work.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
Ellen, does that make sense?
Oh, thank you for... I wondered how that worked.
Okay. All right. So the phone line was working out to Red Butte, but it had been patched into the other wires going out to the building, and so you could call out, but that's not what you wanted to do. That makes perfect sense. So that was a busy day. Y'all had flown up from Tucson, and was that a one journey flight, or did y'all have to stop in Phoenix for fuel or Prescott
no,
or somewhere along the way?
No, they were both just, it only takes what? A little over an hour, Doug, to fly up from there to here.
Yeah.
I mean, there.
Okay.
So it was an hour and a half, 2 hours.
Oh, okay.
So, but it wasn't like you had to stop in Flagstaff or anywhere else for fuel.
The airplane held enough fuel to go up and back on one tank of fuel.
Okay. So y'all got back, and you would have landed at the Tucson runway, and then gotten into vehicles to drive back to Red Butte. But Henry was going to do a tour. Henry and Palin, or Henry and another pilot.
Well, we had at least two other pilots up here while we went down for the funeral.
Okay.
I don't remember how many pilots we had here.
So you had other people, other pilots and ground crew, continuing to fly tours when you all went down for the service.
Right.
Okay. All right. Okay. So then Henry's back, and he's there at the airport, and there's some people that want to go for a flight. The five passengers you mentioned, they were people that Henry knew?
We had just met them a couple of months, a few months before. I don't remember exactly the dates or anything, but I think it was only a couple of months, and we just hit it off. We were the woman and I, as well as Henry's sister and Palin's wife, were all in a Bible group called Bible Study Fellowship, and we had a get together for all of the leaders, and Theta was also a leader, and so I met her there.
So this and was then, at this was at the South Rim, and they were employed working at the South Rim that summer.
No. Our meeting, this couple and their family, took place in California.
Oh, okay.
And Henry had flown us, Margaret and Henry's sister, Jean, and myself. I think that was it. Anyway, somehow Henry met Theta's husband. And Henry invited them to come up to the canyon.
Oh, okay.
So they brought their trailer from California and stayed with us a few days.
Got it. Okay.
And Henry just offered them a ride.
Nice. That's lovely.
Yeah, it was lovely.
Yeah. Okay. So now we have a little bit of background about who was flying and how that day went and why y'all were coming back from Tucson and that, so kind of rounds that out. And then you went back to Ellen and all went back to Red Butte and waited for dinner and waited and waited and waited, and they didn't show up, and that must have been alarming and unusual.
Well, it was, because you don't, I personally never thought it was airplane, but it could have been airplane that they had, maintenance, flat tire, who knows what. You just don't know. You're
exactly.
Just in limbo until
right.
They come home.
And would I be correct in assuming that in limbo is a normal occurrence when communications are what they are, and it's something you just don't worry about?
That's right.
Okay. I mean, in today's day of connectivity, we send texts to each other, when I can't find my sock, it's much more, everybody knows kind of what everybody's doing if they're worried about it. Where are you? What are you doing now? But this was a different life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Am I right, Doug?
Absolutely.
Okay. So Henry finally shows up at 9, and pick the thread up again, please.
Well, and he tells us, of course, what had happened, that the engine had quit. He had tried my husband and his brother and my boys are very proficient pilots, and they're good pilots, and they're careful pilots. And so Henry had tried different gas tanks. He'd done everything that he could to start the engine again, but it was not working. The people, the passengers, did not realize that the engine had quit because the propeller was still windmilling because of the air and so forth. So
right.
He just told them, he said, tighten your seat belts. We're going to land now. And they were over the river. He had to go over the river to that one very small sandbar.
Okay.
And do you want to take it from there, Doug, about the airplane?
Sure. So he just landed, and the sand was so soft that the tires couldn't roll, and so the landing gear collapsed under the airplane.
Oh, so he came in with gear down, not attempting to do a gear up landing, but a gear down landing.
Right. Yeah, the landing gear wasn't retractable.
Okay.
It was, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So, and like Mom said, Dad did not tell the passengers that we were going to land until he said, we're landing now. And they thought that it was just a normal part of the trip. So, they thought, they didn't tell us that about this. And
I guess everybody does this, huh?
Yeah. And so he landed.
So there's a fairly long sandbar, and I should add that Lewis very kindly showed us photos of this event.
Right.
And I was able to locate where on the river this actually was, based on the photographs, which was pretty neat. There's a big long, a runway sized, if you will, a short runway sized, part of the shore of the river just at and below a rapid called Quaggan, Quagunt. And so when you come in with a plane and the landing gear is not retractable, is that gear built to kind of tear away? Because I mean, it seems like there'd be a safety. That would be a good thing. If the landing gear realizes this is not a typical landing, I'm gonna get out of the way so the plane can kind of make a soft touchdown on the ground. Or is that just, you know, the gear, the sand is soft and it just grabs the gear and rips it off?
Yes, it is designed to break off in conditions like that.
Okay.
It's mounted to the wing spar itself, so it's designed so that the spar might be damaged, but it won't get wrecked, if you will.
Okay.
So it's reusable. But even at that, the landing gear did not rip off the airplane.
Okay.
All of the inside the landing gear, it's made like shock absorber on your car.
Okay.
So when you're flying, of course, it's fully extended.
Right.
So the landing was such that when he touched down, the landing gear was still fully extended, but the tires didn't roll because the sand was so soft.
Okay.
And so the tube of the shock absorber just bent in a real nice, smooth curve.
Oh.
So, yeah. And it had fiberglass wheel fenders around the tires, and, of course, they broke up. But that was really all the damage that there was. I was able to just take them apart, put new ones in.
So the next thing I think that would happen is that now the plane is sort of belly to the ground, and that would mean that the propeller is going to start hitting the ground.
Right.
Or had the, was it still, it must have still been windmilling when he would have put the plane in a stall and tried to slow his speed down. Maybe a stall is not the right word to say, but a kind of flared out angle to drop his forward speed.
Right. He would have done a normal landing.
Yeah, okay.
You know, considering the sand and the area where he's landing and stuff like that. So it was a normal, smooth landing.
Okay.
All this is from the passenger that was in the airplane, though, which is amazing. But,
yeah.
So
did the prop get dinged up as it came in, well, or did it just stay horizontal and was no problem?
Unfortunately, no. It stood straight up and down, and just one blade bent.
Okay.
And it was bent just like the landing gear, just a smooth curve to the aft. But that's enough to ruin the blade on the propeller.
And does that impact the engine? Does the engine need to be overhauled after that? Well, of course, the question is, why was the fuel starved? What was going on there? So clearly there's going to be a lot of maintenance required to, get that plane airworthy again.
Back in those days, if the crankshaft turned out true after you took the prop off, it was considered good to go. But they've changed the rules now.
Okay.
And they would call that a prop strike. And
okay.
Then, yes, the engine would need to be overhauled.
Hmm. Okay.
But back then it wasn't. But they did have to take the airplane and disassemble it in order to carry the airplane out.
Right. We'll get to that in a little bit. I kind of want to come back to before that. But yeah, hold that thought. This was June, July, August. What month was this?
I really. What year? When? What month was that month?
Honey, I have not the slightest idea. I really do not know.
Well, I was thinking it was summer, and it was afternoon, and it would have been hot. And these poor people, it would have been cool in the plane when you're flying. It would have been really enjoyable. Then you've got to get out of the plane, unbuckle, and get out, and it's hot.
Yeah. In the bottom of the canyon, it is hot.
So, did Henry like get on the radio when he started having problems? How did the word get out that he was?
I think either Richard Rowland.
It was Richard Rowland who was flying over.
Yeah.
And saw him. Go ahead.
Well, I don't really, but so it was Richard Rowland. And I think Richard watched the landing from the air.
Okay.
No, he didn't.
He didn't? Okay.
No, they didn't know. They just knew that. I mean, it took them a while to realize that he was not coming back.
Richard was on a trip.
Yes. And so the next time when Richard was on the trip, Dad saw him and radioed him. Larry Ely to come and get the people out.
Can I just ask a question here? So Henry didn't make contact with any other pilots or planes when he's flying in. Once he landed, he still had battery power, and then saw or heard a tour plane flying over and radioed out to them?
Yeah.
Okay. Well done.
Yeah.
I don't think he would have had any reception down there in the bottom to the airplanes because with the radio would he, Doug?
Not up to the airport, no. But if there's an airplane flying over, that was easy to do.
Right, so with line of sight, he could have made that connection.
Yeah.
Excellent. All right.
Yeah.
So Richard Rowlands, was he flying Hudgeon planes? Was he flying for you guys?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. And so then Richard's got to figure out how to get you guys out of there, or get Henry and his five passengers out of there. What does he do then? How does he get Larry involved, and who is Larry?
Larry Ely is the guy that runs the airport down in Williams.
Okay.
And he had a helicopter.
Yeah, but I don't think he called Larry Ely. I think he called the guy at Tucson.
It was Larry.
Was it? Okay.
It was Larry.
All right.
So the guy at Tucson, one of those guys that had a helicopter going at the time was Wayne Learn.
Right. Yeah, I couldn't.
The one who took the airplane apart and flew it out.
Okay.
Well, I don't know if he took it apart, but he flew the parts out.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Well. Regardless, it was. It sounds like it was Larry. It somehow, a helicopter then came in to get the passengers out.
Right.
Well, and Henry.
Right.
Now, there's six of them, and a helicopter to carry six people has to be pretty big. I'm assuming then they made a couple of flights to take people out, like three at a time?
Probably. Yeah. I don't know what kind of helicopter Larry had at the time.
Okay.
Well, if I'm wrong about any of this, I'm sure Lewis will correct it.
and that's fine. This is, we're all, trying to recollection roughly something that happened. oh, let me work out the math, 60, 55, something like that years ago. So
yeah,
not bad, right. Not bad. Okay, I mean, gosh, so fortunate to, you know, when you have a failure like that, you are going to land. And there's no question about that. The question is, where are you going to land? And
yeah.
I can assume that Henry and all the pilots in their regular flights, their regular tours, would be thinking, gee, if the engine quits now, well, I would probably put down over there. And, you know, you wouldn't necessarily think about that every flight, but you'd know the lay of the land enough to know, if I run into trouble here, I'm going to try to get to there. I mean, that's a running assumption I have. Do you think that's a correct assumption?
It could be. I will tell you one thing, because Henry, of course, was the last one out of the canyon. He asked the pilot of the helicopter if he would fly over an area that Henry thought that he could get to when the engine quit. But because he was low and the plane was going down faster than he thought it would, he had seen what looked like a plateau that, you know, that he would land on. But he was sinking, so he had to discard that thought and, you know, be focused on where he could land. And so he asked the pilot if he would mind flying over that area. Henry, just out of curiosity, wanted to know what it looked like. Well, God certainly was taking care of him and his passengers, because when they flew over that area, it was nothing but huge boulders, and
oh,
they all would have been killed.
Wow.
So, our God is good all the time.
Lovely. Lovely. So Henry then returns with the helicopter pilot to the airport. He has no plane, but he must have a way to get home. And
yes,
it's
because they drive from Red Butte, from where we were. We had not been ordered off of the land as far as our living quarters were.
Got it. Okay. And the passengers, they had... Were they staying in one of the hotels there on the South Rim, or did they have their own little travel trailer?
I have no idea.
Okay. All right.
I imagine they were staying at the El Tovar, knowing who they were.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So he would have had to make sure that they were taken care of, and that was good. And then head home. Wow. How did that plane get out of there?
They took it apart. They, meaning the crew that...
Wayne Learn had.
Wayne Learn, yeah. And so it took, I think, three or four trips.
Okay.
It took each wing individually. And took the fuselage as another. I don't know if they removed the engine or not. I think Lewis came up with some pictures of it, disassembled and being carried by the helicopter.
Okay.
I think I saw those pictures. So, and it was, I don't know where they dropped it off at, but it was taken back to Tucson, so we never saw it at the Grand Canyon. And it was reassembled there, and the FAA examined it heavily and couldn't find anything wrong with it.
Okay.
Yeah. So it stayed in Tucson for several months. I don't think it ever came back to the Grand Canyon after that. because they could not get it to quit again, and they didn't trust that it wouldn't quit. But eventually it did. And it did two or three times, didn't it, Mom?
Yes, it did, and with the same pilot.
Yeah.
Wait, hang on a second. The same pilot, that would be our hero, Henry.
No, it was one of our employees.
Oh, so it quit multiple times afterwards.
I think it was twice.
Okay.
It might have been three times, but I do remember specific. It probably was three times, but anyway, two times is enough with the same pilot. And when he would land, the jolt would start the engine up again, and so they could never find the problem. That's why I think it was three. So the three times that this happened. Anyway, the last time he had called in and said that it had quit again in the air, and Henry told him, "Well, land softly." And he did, and then it did not jolt it to start again. So they had it in the position of why it quit, the engine.
Okay.
So, Doug, you can carry on. Tell them what happened.
Well, in the meantime, there were other airplanes having the same issue.
Oh.
Yes. And they weren't so lucky.
Ooh.
People were killed.
So, and on those airplanes, they couldn't find the reason either.
Were these all Pipers that were having this problem, or were they different?
All the same make, model, and brand.
Okay.
The same airplane.
So the Cherokee 6.
Yeah.
Okay.
Cherokee 300. So, the FAA, this time they found the problem and they issued a AD note, which stands for Airworthiness Directive. And the part of the directive said the airplanes were not to be flown until the problem was fixed.
Okay.
Talked to a bunch of older guys like myself, and they remember that, working on that back in the day.
Okay. So anybody who had a Cherokee 306 was grounded. That plane was on the ground until further notice.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then who was it who discovered what was wrong?
What'd you say, Mom?
Tell them why.
Oh.
What you found?
Yeah, so the engine is fuel injected, and it's not fuel injected like today's cars. It's mechanically fuel injected.
Okay.
So so instead of a carburetor, of course, it has a servo, which fuel passes through this servo, and it's metered with diaphragms that control the amount of air and also controls the amount of fuel.
Okay.
So one of these diaphragms, there's two, I think there's four of these diaphragms in there, but one of the diaphragms had just a very, very, very tiny pinhole in it, and it was letting air through it. And that was enough to shut off the fuel. It didn't actually shut off the fuel. It just made it so that the amount of fuel going into it was not enough.
So it would have added air, and that would have decreased the fuel-air mixture ratio and decreased the power the engine could produce.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yep. So.
Wow.
Yep. So it fixed it. So they put the airplane back together. And even then, I don't think after that we used it quite a bit, but kept it for many years. It was a good airplane after that.
Okay.
But
used it where there was a runway nearby just in case.
Yeah, you know, eventually you realize that it's not going to quit.
And then take it out a little farther and, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about how to take a plane apart that's on the ground? How do you unhook the wings? How do you unhook the tail? How do you do that?
It's probably the hardest part of it is getting underneath the airplane. So it's going to have to be jacked up because there's a total of 24 for each wing.
I'm sorry, the phone just cut out for a minute. 24 bolts?
Yeah.
Okay, per wing?
Per wing, yeah.
Okay.
Where
are those bolts? How do you get to them?
On this airplane, you take out the middle seats, and it was equipped with three seats in the middle, and they just snap. They come loose just by pushing a button and yanking them out.
Okay.
And then there's the floor that's held in by just six bolt screws. And you take those out, and then there's the bolts right there for the top part of the spar. Those come out fairly easy. But then you have to jack up the airplane and support the fuselage. So I imagine they're doing all that, on the sand.
Okay.
So they have to get it so that they can get under it, take out the rest of the bolts. Once you get all the bolts out, you need to disconnect the cable and operate the flight control and slide the wing out. So all there is to it. It takes three or four guys to carry the wing. It's not because it's heavy, but bulky.
Okay. So three or four guys can carry the wing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. So...
And then once it was off the plane, you'd have to put it in some kind of a sling.
Right.
Unhook it to the helicopter. And.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, for the ailerons and the flaps and stuff like that, brackets off and hook the ropes around the brackets and do it that way. Just put ropes right around the brackets.
Okay.
To hold the flaps. And I forgot you do have to empty the fuel tanks also.
Okay.
So that's done before. But we never flew with very much fuel in there. Just took up too much weight.
Got it. Okay.
So we always under gross when we could do that.
So it would have taken Wayne and his crew a while to do all that. I would assume at least three or four days, something like that.
No, we could do it in a day.
Okay.
Yeah, you'd probably have a crew of at least three guys. Probably four, and you could get it a day.
Okay.
Yeah. And about three-quarters of a day.
And then they would have flown it out and put it on some sort of truck and trailer and driven it to Tucson then.
Right.
Okay. Is there anything else about that event that I haven't asked you that I should ask you?
About the event.
Um,
can't think of anything else. Can you, Mom?
No, I can't.
I don't remember eating dinner that night.
I don't either. I have no idea what happened to those steaks.
I don't remember how we got home from Suzanne to Redview.
Well, it would have been in whatever car we had at that time, because
right.
You had to drive to the airport that morning. I mean, not that morning, but that day.
We rode
all
into town with Dad, so we had to ride back into town, into Tucson with Dad, so I had to probably ride back home with Dad.
Well, see, all of this would have happened before we left for Marie's memorial, for her funeral.
Yeah.
So there would have been a car there.
Well, we had the Ford then. So, but you guys, maybe you rode with Aunt Margaret.
I don't remember how we got home.
Don't remember either.
You know, I could have gone with Ralph and Theta too. I don't know.
I just remember it was darker than dark by the time Dad got back.
So yes, it was.
Yeah. Uh huh. So
now, did you come home with us after the memorial, or did you stay at the airport?
I stayed at the airport.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. And I think all of us stayed at the airport.
Well, that's what I thought, too.
You know, I remember all of us guys sitting on the logs out there wondering why Dad was so late. And I think I don't remember if Richard had passengers or not, but I remember Richard coming back and just saying, "Dad's down in the canyon," and that sent my heart up to my throat.
Yeah,
I remember that, but you know, it was the next thing was, well, what's going on, kind of thing, and. We had to have eaten those steaks because I was hungrier than hungry that night. It was really late.
Yeah, it was. It was after 9 by the time you came home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you wouldn't have been wondering about Dad. You would have known by that time where he was. It was just be a matter of when they could get Dad out and what Dad had to do. Probably with getting the airplane out. I don't know.
Well, that didn't happen that night.
Well, something kept him there till 9 o'clock. They weren't going down in the canyon.
No. No. It was...
Yeah, they had to do that pretty quickly because I don't know what time we got back from that morning. It could have been before lunch. I don't know.
You know,
no, we got back late because when we got home, the Theta and Ralph were there at the airport waiting for us. And Dad took them on a ride, and it was more like, oh, man, now we have to wait for that. Well,
I know.
Yeah. And so we all landed with them. And then the Spangens came, and Dad Halen went home, and Dad said, "I'll take him." And then as he was getting in the airplane, that motorcycle rider guy came. He was by himself. And so it was, here we go again, And so, but it was just a short ride, so 30 minutes and we'll be on our way home. Well, it was 45 minutes before we started wondering what was going on.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, the flights, they were always on time.
Sorry, Tom, we're doing this reminiscing.
I'm loving this. I'm just a church mouse on the in the corner here listening with my little microphone.
It's funny, you just don't think about those things until you're, you know, you start talking about it.
And one thing I'm thinking is, okay, let's assume it was later in the afternoon. It's going to be a 30-minute flight. That's not bad. Henry goes out, and Henry doesn't come back. That means someone, in this case Richard, is like, well, where are they? So he has to get in a plane. He has to fly out. If this scenario that y'all are talking about, if this makes sense, Henry sees him, gets him on the radio, says, hey, I'm down here, and send help. Then Richard has to fly back. So now that's at least another 30 to 60 minutes after, another hour's gone. I mean, Henry goes out for his flight. He doesn't come back. So it's going to take a while for somebody to spool up a plane and go look for him. So there's another hour. And then Richard has to come back to the airport. He has to contact the person with the helicopter. And then they have to fly in. So now we're into our third hour, and the day is getting long. And then he has to fly twice to get the people out. And that's probably at dusk is that last flight. I'm just laying this out as a possible scenario. And that makes perfect sense. It's summertime, so dusk is going to be late in the day, 7:30, 8 o'clock.
Right. And that's kind of the way it was. I don't think the helicopter, of course, I have no idea. We never saw the helicopter or the passengers. I think they went straight to the motel, or where did...
Oh, bingo. So thank you, because the helicopter would have been operating out of Tucson across the street from the Red Feather.
Well...
Red Feather wasn't there, was it, Doug?
No, it was the Moki.
I don't remember Red Feather.
It was the Moki Lodge then.
Okay. All right.
Okay, sorry about that. But the helicopter down along, well, the Wayne Learn had a space that he and Thurston had gone into agreement with to operate out of right there where the road went past down through that meadow. But that was away from the airport.
Yes, that's right.
So Richard is flying his plane. He had to land at the airport. He had to find a vehicle. He had to go over to where the helicopter port was. And then make arrangements to send the helicopter person in, saying, well, this is where they are. Go get them.
Yeah, except he would have done that by phone.
Okay. Oh, all right. All right, that makes
by
sense.
By radio, even.
Okay.
I think we had the tower then. I don't remember totally.
Well, even so, being up in the air like he would have been, he would have had...
He didn't call us on the Unicom, and maybe he did, but we were all sitting out on the log.
Mm, okay.
Like bumps on the log. So he could have called Wayne Learn, and Wayne Learn could have called Larry Ely. That's all speculation.
Sure. But there would have been... some sort of helicopter tourage happening in that summer, right there out of Tucson.
Right.
So that's a possibility. Maybe it was out of Williams, and that would have taken even longer. For because there'd be that travel time up there that way. So one way or the other, makes sense that it was a long afternoon for all involved and a very fortunate afternoon as well.
Yes.
Yeah. So. Another thing is we didn't want to play with the competitors, so we wouldn't have called them.
Okay. Well, they didn't have helicopters, did they? I mean, there's nothing they could have done anyway.
I don't know if they...
Not the competitors that were next to us. They didn't have helicopters.
They didn't. We always thought that they operated with, or were in cahoots with Wayne Learn. I, again, don't know.
Okay.
That would be why they never called Learn. Wayne Learn had Bell 206s, so it would only make sense that Larry Uly did too.
That's a certain type of helicopter.
Yeah, it's a four-place helicopter, or a five-place helicopter.
Okay, so either way, the pilot is one place, so now there's only room for four, so he's going to have to make two trips.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. All right, and the plane comes out, and I should probably add, just for the record, that as a physical therapist at the South Rim Clinic for many years, I met the coach of the high school, a gentleman named Dan Lopez. And Dan and I went out for dinner one night, and Dan told me the story of that Wayne had hired him to fly in and help take this plane apart.
Oh, really? Cool.
So I knew of the story, but none of the details.
Yeah.
So it's lovely to visit with you all today and get the rest of the story.
Yeah.
We're glad to hear it, too.
Yeah.
You know, we've been going for almost an hour here. Maybe this is a good time to just keep this interview focused on that one event, and put a comma in this interview series, and we'll visit again next time. What do you think?
That sounds good.
Is there anything else about this accident and its plane recovery that you want to add that we haven't talked about?
I don't think so. You know, when something like this happens, I'll put it this way. First thing that usually happens is you get sued. And that wasn't even part of the equation, questioning or anything like that. The passengers were totally, well, it was a different era also. So, but they were, that would not happen today is all I'll say. It just wasn't even a thought. I'm sure that the air about it, but after it was over.
It's funny, one thing you said, it made me think, well, the passengers were like, okay, this is part of the tour. Cool, we get to land by the river.
Right.
Oh, you mean this isn't? Oh, you mean we're on the ground? Oh, what?
Yeah. You know, it's all what if.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So that, I mean, you don't panic until after it's over.
Well, that's some mighty good flying on Henry's part.
Yeah.
Yep. Oh. Thank you, Lord.
Indeed. Well, with that, let's conclude part 7. Of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Ellen Hudgen and her son Doug. My name is Tom Martin, and today is Tuesday, May 7th, 2024. Ellen and Doug, thank you so very much.
You're very welcome.